sports are really important vehicles for relationships.
We have purpose. We have a why. We bring people together. We connect.
I feel like God is our greatest supporter and our greatest coach.
Welcome to Rabbi on the Sidelines. This is Rabbi Ara Sherman from Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. This week, we are joined by John Eisenberg, author of 11 books, but his newest book out just recently called Rocket Men, the Black Quarterbacks Who Revolutionized Pro Football. We see Warren Moon and, of course, Patrick Mahomes. We're going to talk a lot about him and the Super Bowl. And is he the next Tom Brady or is he Patrick Mahomes? We are so honored to have John here joining us from Baltimore. John, thanks for joining us on Rabbi on the Sidelines.
Oh, well, Rabbi, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So I have so many questions about this book. Again, author of Rocket Men, the Black Quarterbacks Who Revolutionized Pro Football. Because it's interesting, you brought a lot of history to me that I never knew, because as I told you off the air, I grew up with black quarterbacks, specifically Donovan McNabb in Syracuse, and watching him take his presence on the college stage and the NFL stage. But something that really struck me about your book was Jackie Robinson, because every child knows who Jackie Robinson is, what he meant to baseball, but not many people really speak about who is the Jackie Robinson of football. Why is that the case, that we all know who the Jackie Robinson is of baseball, but not really until your book did I even think about the question about who the Jackie Robinson is in football?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And the difference, because if you go way back in the history, I mean, it's pretty similar. Baseball was entirely segregated until Jackie Robinson crossed the line and started playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. And the NFL was also all white from 1934 through the end of World War II. So it's not that the first 12 or 13 years of the NFL, there were a few black players, but then they pretty much decided they're not going to do that. Tough period in the league's history when you look back on it. However, with the case of Jackie, with baseball, all right, there was one moment. Jackie Robinson crosses the line, the white lines. He's playing. Everything changes, right? Suddenly, there's a lot more black players in the major leagues, and the sport is never the same. Football, it's just not that story at all, especially when it comes to quarterbacks and black quarterbacks. There was, after the league reintegrated after World War II, there were just a trickle of black players in the league and no quarterbacks. And very slowly, only slowly, starting in the 60s and going forward, were there a few black quarterbacks in football. And so it's there's like a thousand little Jackie Robinsons. It's a story where there's just slowly the door of opportunity opens for black quarterbacks. And it was many steps along the way, most of them little. And some of them not even noticed at the time. However, so it's not that one moment where we can have a holiday and put a number up and do everything. It's completely different. It's just a very slow story, a story of opportunity slowly coming to this population.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. You don't have the number 42 anywhere in terms of Jackie. We're down the street from UCLA. 42 is plastered all over the place, but you don't have that. And one of those slow stories was with the Raiders, I believe. The story of quarterback, I believe, James Dickey. You have these moments of almost breakthroughs. Maybe tell his story and why the almost didn't make it.
Well, Eldridge Dickey, yes, is he's the first in modern football in the 60s, the first black quarterback drafted in the first round draft pick. And he was an incredible talent. The Oakland Raiders took him, not an NFL team, by the way. Some football fans will notice that AFL team, that was right after the merger had been signed, but before it took place, it was still an AFL team. So they scouted Eldridge Dickey, and an unbelievable talent. He could throw with both hands. He could run. He was very much a modern quarterback, what you would see today. So they took him in the first round. But what happened in the 60s, almost always to black quarterbacks, was that they were shifted. They had to change positions in the pros, right? Because the thinking in the pro game was, and it's just racist ideology, it's the only way to put it. The thinking in the pro game was they might not be smart enough to handle these complex offenses. Will they work hard enough? Will white teammates, can they be leaders? Can they come through in the clutch? All this stuff. And there was no chance to disprove it because no black quarterbacks could ever get on the field. So Eldridge Dickey, very quickly, the Raiders already had a ton of, they took him in the first round. Good for them. It was a great moment. However, they took Kenny Stabler in the second round, and they already had the MVP in the league, Darrell LaMonica, at quarterback. There was no place for him to play, and he wound up being a receiver and having very little pro career. And so good for the Raiders for taking that step, but they threw him into a situation where he really wasn't going to succeed. And this is a young man with great talent. There was no place for him to play. And the story of the black quarterback is full of guys like this. Mm-hmm. Tremendous talent. There's almost no doubt with the backing of an organization, the type you see today, that they could have produced a starting caliber quarterback, but he just didn't get the opportunity.
And so it's interesting that it seems like American history also parallels what's happening. You know, when I say, oh, Rockman, I'll read about these quarterbacks that I know about. But I was learning so much about American history, reading about the story of the NFL, the AFL, the mergers, and the black quarterback. And one thing that came to mind was Marlon Briscoe and the Broncos, the same year that MLK is assassinated. How do those two stories go together or not go together to see the progress or not the progress of what was happening throughout football?
Well, yeah, in the fall of 68, after the MLK assassination, and of course, you know, Robert Kennedy's assassination, a very volatile year in American history, and then the height of the civil rights movement. And Marlon Briscoe is a young black quarterback from a smaller school, University of Omaha, that the Denver Broncos took in a late round. And again, they were going to move positions. He had been really good college quarterback, small college quarterback. Good arm, good leader, could throw. But then when they drafted him, the Denver Broncos, again, an AFL team, not an NFL team, they said, you're going to be a defensive back. And so he was that until the season started. He made the team. And all the quarterbacks, all of them white, got hurt. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, well, we don't really have a choice. They put this guy on the field. And now, would that have happened 10 years earlier? I think is a fair question. They just would have found some other solution. The idea of it being a black athlete, I think is very debatable, whether that would have happened 10 years earlier, 10 years later. And you start to see this in the late 60s, you do start to see a loosening of that ideology that I spoke of earlier. There are younger scouts in the game, there are younger coaches, and there's just starting to be a different approach to looking at a black athlete and saying everything that you can't do, which was sort of the prevailing thing, certainly when it came to quarterbacks. Finally, it was what can you do? So minds were starting to open a little bit. That's not to say that he had much of an opportunity. He played great. He played, started five games for the Broncos that fall. The Broncos were not very good, but he played great, and he thought he was going to be the starter, but they never let him play quarterback again. They had quarterbacks meetings immediately after the season. He wasn't even invited. He had to change teams and change positions to have a pro career. And so he really is a textbook example of, yes, he got a little bit of an opportunity, but yet the constrictions that had been in place for decades were still there. And so it just shows you the difficulty that the black athlete, the black quarterback was facing. It's still in that era.
And the name Upton Bell, it was an interesting person that I had never heard of before, but is really also part of this process. Describe who he was and what that meant to the game.
Upton has been a great source for me on several books. His father, Burt Bell, is a lion of NFL history. He started the Philadelphia Eagles and became commissioner of the league from 46 through 59. It was his idea. This is his dad. It was his idea to have a draft, just a seminal moment in the history of pro football. There was no draft, and they had no system for how they were going to put college talent onto teams. And so the rich got richer, the Bears and the Giants back then. Burt Bell was the one that said, we got to have something here. I'm going to be out of business. So they had a draft, just a, you know, tremendous figure. And Upton is his son. And so Upton grew up in football, grew up with a dad who, you know, at the kitchen table was sitting with his telephone, making up the schedule, you know, the NFL schedule. And so Upton gets into pro football after college. And he, as a young man in the 60s, is a scout. He's a scout for the Baltimore Colts. And so I used him as an example of a young guy that went out on the road, and what he was seeing in the 60s, what he was hearing from the other scouts, which was these black quarterbacks, they can't play for us, and from the NFL scouts. And Upton was like, that's just bull, you know? I mean, he would go. So his experience I used driving through the South to HBCUs and seeing these quarterbacks, he would make those stops and say, these guys are great. I mean, you know, the things that we now know, these guys can definitely play. But so his experience I found to be sort of illuminating. You know, what he was, boots on the ground at the period of time when the NFL was, there was a hard line against black quarterbacks. And he's part of the generation that started to change it.
And so you mentioned HBCUs. That was actually my next question. I remember watching every year the Grambling game. And what was the power of the HBCUs to bring the black quarterback to the attention of America? And I know some of these black quarterbacks chose to go to those schools because they could have the opportunity to be the quarterback.
Yes, Eldridge Dickey being one that we talked about earlier. I mean, the white schools, not the white schools, but the major college football was still pretty much segregated. He's from Texas. He's from Houston. Mm-hmm. And if he was going to play college football in Texas, it wasn't going to be at University of Texas or SMU or any of those places. They were still segregated. So they had all white teams only in the late 60s. So the HBCUs became a landing place for quarterbacks, black quarterbacks, and really for talent of many, I mean, for at all positions. What's really interesting, if you go back and look at, say, the drafts of the late 60s, so the NFL discovered this pool of talent that was just ignored. It was being ignored. And finally, some people, Upton and others, came along and said, these guys are fabulous. I mean, have you looked at them? And so they started drafting them. Tons of players coming out of the HBCUs in the draft in the 60s and into the 70s. And of course, I mean, it's almost like Negro League baseball. What happened was then the major colleges all said, whoa, well, you know, these guys are great. We'll start taking black players. And so that lesson, it diluted the talent that was at the HBCUs pretty quickly. In the 60s, in the mid 60s through the early 70s, it was, they were unbelievable pool of talent, and some quarterbacks came out of there.
And so it's not just the quarterbacks, but it also takes somebody in the administrations, the coaches, the managers, the owners, to sort of break that line. And I know John McKay was an influence in Tampa Bay with tolerance. Why did he decide to do that? Was it what you just said? He saw this pool of talent. Was it finally just about a win and not about a skin color? What did he do there that changed the trajectory?
Yes. I mean, there are stories, the black quarterback story, by necessity, it's unfortunate, but by necessity, there are, white figures that had the power. So many had the power to affect change and didn't use it, didn't want to try. And then there's just a little few that did. And, you know, to their credit, and John McKay certainly was one. He was a college coach at USC, at Southern Cal, and he was using black quarterbacks in the 60s. And a pretty sophisticated offense where they ran, they passed, and he won with black quarterbacks. There's a 1969 cover Sports Illustrated, Jimmy Jones, a black quarterback at Southern Cal. It's on the cover of Sports Illustrated in 1969, a very powerful image in the sports world at that time that I think shocked people. And then McKay has great success at Southern Cal and goes to Tampa Bay, in the NFL, and right off the bat starts using black quarterbacks. And so he just didn't see color at that position, years ahead of his time, by the way, compared to so many others in football. He just felt like it was just, it's just how he was baked. It was, this is silly that we're even having this conversation. And so that, again, years ahead of time. And so Doug Williams, who he drafted and ultimately won the Super Bowl for the then Washington Redskins. I interviewed Doug for this book, and he's like, John McKay now, that, you know, is a lion in this story because he took a lot of heat for me. And, you know, he just took it on by drafting me and putting me out there with Tampa in the late 70s, you know, a period of time. And as Doug said, you know, you can't get any farther south than Tampa. I mean, right. You know, he knew he was going to alienate a lot of fans, but he did it anyway. So, you know, John McKay, great figure.
So once you get to the middle of this book, then you finally sort of define Doug Williams as a Jackie Robinson. As I'm reading, I'm like, he's going to do it? No, he's going to do it? No. And finally get to Doug. How did Doug Williams become that person that led to this next generation? We'll talk about Warren Moon and all those Randall Cunninghams in a minute. Those are the guys that I grew up thinking about, not knowing all these stories. How did Doug Williams lead to those?
Well, yes, out of all those moments, when I said 1,000 little moments, the biggest one, without a doubt, is Doug Williams leading the Washington Redskins to a Super Bowl victory, Super Bowl 22, 1988.
You're an encyclopedia. This is amazing.
What's that?
You're an encyclopedia. This is awesome.
Hey, I wrote the book. But yes, I covered that game for the Baltimore Sun. Wow. And I was there. And yeah, I mean, they were playing the Denver Broncos. John Elway was everything that the NFL wanted from a quarterback. Big, strong arm. It's sort of the image that the NFL quarterbacks had always been, white. You know, a great quarterback, obviously. But and it was against Doug Williams and the Redskins. And Doug wasn't even a starter most of the year. He just came in at the end of the season. And he had there's so much pressure on him in that game. Looking back on it, can you imagine? You know, how many millions of people are watching and what percentage of those millions have real doubts about whether a black quarterback can win a Super Bowl or can even play. That was still the question in the late 80s. And so he has a great game, throws 5 touchdown passes and before halftime and wins the game. And it just puts to rest so many things, stereotypes about black quarterbacks. He came through in the clutch. He was wins a championship. His teammates loved him. And it was great. And so that did more. Never again could you just say, well, you can't get where you want to go with a black quarterback. You couldn't say that anymore. So of all the moments, it's the biggest, no doubt.
I also found an interesting trend when you talk about the reserve quarterbacks, that even when the black quarterbacks were getting their opportunity to play, once they, for instance, were back on the bench, there was no room on the bench. You were either the starter or off the team. Analysis on that in terms of, like, you're in or you're out, but there's never really that middle ground.
Yeah, you're really right about that. And it is something that's continued until very recently. And I do think it's the last vestige of sort of the old school thinking, whether it be conscious or unconscious bias. And, you know, it may be unconscious in many cases. I'm always very careful to, you know, I'm painting with broad brush here and it's a little tricky, you know, we're involving a lot of people. And I hesitate to ascribe any sentiments to individuals, you know, or something like that. You never know. But the fact of the matter was there were very few black backup quarterbacks. Now, the backup quarterback is a job where you have to prepare like you're going to play. You have to know the playbook, have to be smart. You're almost a coach. You're in the huddle with the coach a lot of times, and you have to prepare and really be smart. And so I think what you saw was teams reflexively sticking with white quarterbacks in that position. And it was unusual that Doug was a backup in 1988 and got an opportunity. But that continued. That has continued, really, it in some respects, still goes on today, that you see a lot more white backup quarterbacks than black. It is changing, like the rest of the black quarterback narrative. But it was the case until recently. I think for coaches were just reflexively more comfortable with the white quarterback in that role. And so it was, that was not a good situation. And it's something that needed to change.
So two quarterbacks of the modern era. I'll give you my age. I was born in 1982. So Warren Moon, one of the really first quarterbacks that I remember in my life. Randall Cunningham, I'm a huge Eagles fan. My parents are from Philly. That was like the quarterback that I emulated. It's interesting, off the football field, their stories are almost similar in terms of the hardships that they deal with, specifically with their parents, losing their parents and sort of becoming the man of the house and having to make difficult decisions, basically being playmakers in their own lives. Do you think that led to any of the success that they could handle on the field in terms of being those model black quarterbacks?
I think certainly in Warren Moon's case, there, you can draw a straight line very easily that Warren grew up in L.A. His dad died.
Hamilton High School, right down the street.
Right, right. His dad died when he was very young, and he was raised with six sisters. And so he's the man of the house from like age eight. And in our interview, he told me this story that, yeah, I mean, that's why age 12, youth football, his coaches have already spotted the sort of the traits of leadership of quarterback. Mm-hmm. And when it comes from, he's been taking out the garbage, you know, since he was eight or nine and looking out for some sisters. And so sort of was an old soul. It turned him into an old soul, but it also turned him into a leader. And so he was a natural quarterback, Warren Moon. And it took a long time for him to get to the NFL. I mean, he University of Washington, wins the Rose Bowl as a senior, doesn't even get drafted, goes to Canada and plays 6 years
Edmonton,
there, where there's more open-mindedness in the Canadian football in that era, and wins five championships. He's just an elite talent. Finally gets to the NFL in 1984. And
30 years old, right?
What's that?
30 years old.
Yeah, well, not quite 30, but close to it. Close to it. And so he's a huge figure in the story because there are no black quarterbacks starting in the NFL when he lands with the Houston Oilers in 1984. None. And the league is 64 years old at that point. And so you have to start somewhere, right? I mean, there'd been a little trickle of opportunity, not a lot. And so from the get-go, Warren Moon is just great. He's as you said, first quarterback you remember. A lot of people have memory. I mean, Warren Moon played for 16 years. He threw for 50,000 yards. He made the Pro Bowl every year. He didn't win a Super Bowl, didn't even get to a Super Bowl, but he was just an elite quarterback and just a great player. And so you couldn't look at him and say, oh, a black quarterback can't play in the NFL. You just couldn't. I mean, so he did it for forever, it felt like. And so just, you know, I can't think of anyone. I mean, Doug Williams had the one moment, but Warren Moon just debunked the myths consistently for so long that you couldn't voice them anymore. And Randall Cunningham, who you mentioned, was another with the Eagles. And again, both his parents died when he was in college at UNLV. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, he's an interesting case. He's from California and sort of laid back, not from the Deep South like a lot of these other guys who really dealt with truly searing sort of almost post Jim Crow style stuff. Randall was a little different. He's from Santa Barbara.
Right.
And, but nonetheless, he certainly burned, you know, there's some fire inside of him, I mean, he was just an undiscovered talent, an incredible player, you know, he just was waiting for someone to discover him and get the opportunity. And he was fortunate that he did. And so once given that opportunity and, you know, he just made the most of it. You know, you could count on one hand to that point, the number of black quarterbacks who had an opportunity. He did and made the most of it. And really those three guys, Moon, Cunningham, and Doug Williams are the ones that really started opening.
And you have to say, Rabbi on the Sidelines, intersection of sports and faith, Randall Cunningham, a great preacher in the Vegas area right now as well, which is exciting to see him. Obviously, Reggie White on that team was already an ordained minister and really a person of faith, which is really cool to see that intersection as well. And then in 1988, two black quarterbacks start the Pro Bowl history, right? Not two black quarterbacks on the team, but two starting basically the All-Star game. Did that propel anything. And it's interesting because towards the end of the book, you basically say, when can we get rid of saying the black quarterback and just he's a quarterback?
Well, not at the 1989 Pro Bowl. You couldn't do it because it had never happened. And yeah, I mean, they it was Warren Moon and Randall Cunningham. And you look, Warren Moon is an interesting to talk to about this because when he went into the Hall of Fame in 2006, he said, I really have been uncomfortable with the label of trailblazer because I just wanted to be a quarterback, not a black quarterback. But 10, 15 years later, he gets it, fully understands. And the 1989 Pro Bowl would be a classic example of the barriers that he was busting along the way. He said, I can see now, and he's an older man, he's a grandfather, he gets that what he did was open the door for so many guys that are having so much success now. And he did it in many, many ways. And so, yeah, that would be a great example. I mean, Warren Moon, not only starting the Pro Bowl along with Randall, but he is, out of all his numbers, and one thing you won't see on his Hall of Fame plaque is that he was the first black quarterback to start a game for four teams. And so four different teams. So that's what, there's 32 in the league. So, you know, the double digit percentage, Warren Moon broke the barrier. So yeah, he, you know, there's stories like, you know, moments like that along the way are a key part of this.
And what blew me away is some draft numbers at the 1999 NFL draft. I believe there were as many quarterbacks taken as in the last 62 years of the draft, one of them being Donovan McNabb, the number two, not the number one. We'll get to number one, Michael Vick, in a few moments. And that's part of the history, as I said, told you offline, that I lived through. Being a kid in Syracuse, I would ride my bicycle over to Manly Fieldhouse. And I vividly remember the quarterback competition. And they were all black quarterbacks in 1996, which was Keith Downing, who's now, I believe, a doctor, Kevin Johnson, who did become a wide receiver and a great punt returner in the NFL, and Donovan McNabb. His first start was against, I can't believe I remember this, North Carolina. It was right before the high holidays. And I witnessed that. And I witnessed his parents as well, watching him. And it's interesting, you write about his parents, Sam and Wilma from Chicago, saying that I fought in Vietnam for this country, but now I'm back here and I'm facing racism. And there was this like contradiction. So talk a little about Donovan and what that meant to first going to college, and Paul Pasqualoni, Coach P, who's a lovely, good friend of ours, gave him an opportunity. Back then, it didn't seem like it was an issue at all. And going to the Eagles at number two.
Yes. Boy, I should have called you. You got some good.
A new footnote. Yes.
Yeah. Some good. You would have been in. That's some good information there. But you were eyewitness to a lot. But Donovan is, his story is amazing. This, and it's a modern story, as you know, that, as you said, you know, it's one that a lot of people remember and saw. And at Syracuse, there was a history. There are some of the northern schools, colleges, were willing to take black quarterbacks on much earlier, and Syracuse was one of them.
Don McPherson, you even mentioned him, but didn't get drafted.
Well, yes, and Don McPherson, but years before, Bernie Custis, like in the early 50s, they had a black quarterback throw for 1,000 yards in a season. So they were willing. Michigan State, by the way, was another one where there was always the door of opportunity was often open. But Syracuse, so, you know, Donovan, he experienced a lot in his recruitment coming out of a high school in Chicago that a lot of black quarterbacks did, which was, we want you if you're willing to change positions.
Wow.
And so he experienced that. So Syracuse was willing to take him as a quarterback. So that's why he went there. And you know, he was always sort of very mature and a pro before he was a pro. And, you know, smart guy, level-headed. And so he made the most of it. And he ran an offense. You saw the offense, right? I mean, it wasn't just straight passing.
Option.
So up to the point where he's drafted, if you're a black quarterback running an option offense, you're not going to get drafted. NFL teams wanted, this story is that NFL teams wanted dropback passers. That was slowly changing when Donovan came along in the late 90s, fortunately for him. Mm-hmm. So he was just so talented. But the fact that he was an option quarterback, It could have knocked him out of the draft, but in 1999, by then, Cordell Stewart was in the league, Steve McNair was in the league, and the situation was starting to change, and they look at this guy with great talent, and the Philadelphia Eagles took him second with the second pick. And of course the famous story is that he was booed. They were booed because all the Eagle fans were in attendance.
Ricky Williams.
And they wanted him to take Ricky Williams, the running back from Texas. And so, you know, the Eagles didn't do that. And that had been sort of spurred on by some talk radio in Philadelphia. And it just, so he was booed as a 21-year-old when he's drafted and it's going to be the future. And really, goes on to have just a great career with the Eagles. Got him to a Super Bowl, got him, you know, tons of playoff wins. Did he win a Super Bowl? No.
Right.
You know, he dealt with the terrible, criticism sometimes. And some of it, you know, the Rush Limbaugh incident in 2003 that I write about, where he's singled out. And so just because he's a black quarterback. So he dealt with a lot, but he you know, was a great winning quarterback for many years, had a great career with the Eagles.
It's really interesting now that I think about this and what you say about him and the idea of a black quarterback. I don't know if you know, but he played basketball in the 1996 Final Four team. He was a walk-on. And I have his autograph, and he used to sign his name. I have it in my office in the program. They don't make programs anymore. It says Donovan McNabb, number 24, QB. He signed it QB. And I'm wondering, just based on reading your book now, like you say, I am a quarterback. I would love to ask him that question, but really interesting.
Yes. That's got some symbolism to it. That's for sure.
Yeah. I'm going to send you a picture of that autograph to prove the evidence. And now we move on to these, you know, I got to witness Lamar Jackson when he played the Chargers out here this past year. You have a modern quarterback. You have Patrick Mahomes, who's now compared to the next Tom Brady, who's just a quarterback. Take us through this modern era of what this means, and is there a trajectory? What do you see in the next? Or actually, let's back up for a second. We got to talk about Michael Vick, because I also got to witness him in person. A very famous game, Syracuse against Virginia Tech, when McNabb threw a pass, tight end pass, back in the end zone to Steve Braminski, a tight end. If you haven't seen that one, it's amazing. We were hugging people that we didn't even know in the, next to each other. But Michael Vick went on a recruiting visit to Syracuse, and he said that McNabb was his mentor. But at the same time, Vick went through maybe a little different trajectory in his life than Donovan McNabb. What's the similarities? What's the differences between those two black quarterbacks?
Well, McNabb certainly was from a nuclear, you know, an intact household, strongly supported. Not that Vic wasn't, but Vic was definitely, as he writes in his autobiography, much tougher area where he grew up, and you know, very football was his escape from where he grew up in Virginia, the Norfolk area, Newport News, and so Vic is really an interesting story, an interesting chapter of the black quarterback story, because his talent was just surpassing. It's no one had ever played quarterback like that before. And he really was years ahead of his time with his ability to run and throw and make plays and just redefine what a quarterback was, really the best athlete on the field and not just a drop back passer and an amazing player. And so he did change a lot of minds and was an athlete. Also one of the first black quarterback athletes, you know, who, corporate America embraced. I mean, he had major, he was loved by young people. He was electric. And so he had some great sponsorships going, Coca-Cola and some other, I'm trying to remember what the other ones were. However, you know, he brought his whole world down. As you know, he got involved and he was hanging out with the wrong people. And his autobiography is a stunning book where he, and the mistakes he was making and the people he was hanging out with, and the lack of care that he showed for himself and his career and his friends. And so he brought it all down. It's a dogfighting scam. He was running a dogfighting ring. He's caught and ends up in prison, ends up at Leavenworth in Kansas, and where he spends a lot of time looking in the mirror, I think, and wondering what in the world. And Donovan McNabb, his mentor, comes along and helps pave the way for a second chance for him in the NFL. So Vic, it's interesting because you get to the late 90s and we were starting to have black quarterbacks, as I mentioned, Cordell Stewart, Steve McNair, Donovan McNabb became another one. Vic sort of as great as he was, then suddenly it was like, I think he sort of brought to light the concerns that a lot of white ownership had over time. What if we do invest in a black quarterback? Look what happens. Look what happens when you know, the biggest of the big stars and, you know, makes mistakes and I'm not sure about this. And so what you see in the narrative of the black quarterback is slowly rising into the late 90s, but then it stalls for sure. You don't see the numbers go up. You see some hesitancy on the parts of teams, very few first round picks. And so for about a period of 10 or 12 years, there's not much change. And it's kind of shocking when you look at that. So I think Vic had something to do with that. But then what happens? I don't know if you want. I mean, you mentioned those other guys. I think to me, it all changed starting in the early, like 2011. You have Cam Newton drafted. You have Colin Kaepernick drafted. In 2012, you have Robert Griffin drafted and Russell Wilson drafted. And those four guys, that's a generation that came into the league and changed how quarterback position is played. And that's the first time where NFL teams, and I interviewed Ozzie Newsome, the general manager of the Baltimore Ravens, and he said, listen, until those guys came along, what we did in the NFL was you coming out of college, you're going to have to play our style of football. But when they came along, we said, you know what? It's time to change. We are going to be the ones who change, and we're going to let them do what they do. And we're going to let quarterbacks be more mobile, run around, throw on the run, run pass options. It just became a different position slowly with those guys who were so good and successful. And so from that point forward, I think you've seen the quarterback position really, really change in the NFL. And sort of the next generation after those guys, we're looking at them now, Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson. There's more generations coming. You know, these young guys, C.J. Stroud. We're going to have Caleb Williams go first overall this year. Who knows who's going to emerge? But to me, it's the story of what's happened in the last 12 or 13 years.
Can you just comment on the Kaepernick piece? Was he too early for his time in terms of sort of, we talk about race and black quarterbacks and what he did, and sort of was modeled across the world in different sports and how to use sports as a place for social justice?
Well, that aspect of his story, of course, far outweighs what happened on the football field and in my mind, and it that's certainly going to be his legacy. And it's a tremendous one. Really. And he, because he did, you know, he got the NFL never apologizes for anything, but, you know, after the, you know, he has gotten after George Floyd and sort of the racial reckoning that was happening there, the NFL said, hey, you know, we were wrong. We were wrong. In what we thought when you go back to 2017, and what was the protest that when the black players were protesting and kneeling for the national anthem, which Kaepernick started, you know, we didn't understand what that was about. And so Colin was really right, and so he is a tremendous figure in social justice and society in this history. In the book, what I used him as, I felt it was important, was the football aspect of it, and it's sort of forgotten. Mm-hmm. And Colin Kaepernick, as a young player drafted by the 49ers, was unbelievable. He was so talented. I remember watching a playoff game where they played the Green Bay Packers, and I thought, this guy, he's big, tall, with long legs. He ran all over the place. He threw. I said, this guy may be the best quarterback I've ever seen. He's unstoppable. He was unstoppable. With Jim Harbaugh as his coach, he was just a phenomenal young player, and he was 5 yards away from winning a Super Bowl as a second-year player. And so what it shows is that that was the sort of the pinnacle, and he was never quite as good, and then Harbaugh left, and his football career went downhill a little bit. But then it was over long before it should have been. And so You know, it shows how good he was as an early player. It shows because he gave up his career. He gave up his career to do what he did. Mm-hmm. And it really could have been a much better career than it was.
And so the last question, because it's Rabbi on the Sidelines, intersection of sports and faith through all of these stories, all these challenges, these hardships, achievements, victories, defeats. Is there faith in football?
Is there faith in football? Yes, there's definitely faith in football. My last job was working for the Baltimore Ravens. And so certainly their coach, John Harbaugh, very upfront about his faith and starts many of his press conferences that way. And up close, you know, the players, Lamar Jackson does the same. And you just, it's all around. I mean, I was sort of inside the locker room there, and I that would just be anecdotally what, you know, what I saw with my two eyes is for sure. I mean, there's a team chaplain and, you know, he's in the locker room a lot and he's on the team plane and talking to a lot of guys and it's there. I mean, it's just, you know, it seems at the forefront of a lot of guys' minds, even as they're playing. So I would say the answer to that is a resounding yes.
Wow. Love it. We are honored to have John Eisenberg, author of this amazing book, Rocket Men, the Black Quarterbacks Who Revolutionized Pro Football. We look forward to not just seeing the next generation of black quarterbacks, but the generation of quarterbacks who use their identity to really make a difference on the field, but as importantly, off the field. John, it's so wonderful to have you on Rabbi on the Sidelines, and we look forward to speaking with you soon. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Sports are really important vehicles for relationships.
We have purpose. We have a why. We bring people together. We connect.
I feel like God is our greatest supporter and our greatest coach.